And then, you know, the rest is history. You know, we have the Nowotnys that are going to have two kids. We have the Rubleys that are going to have two kids. The Berkmeyers are going to back three kids. Four, really? And now, okay, that's crazy. And then last week, you know, we shared that there was one little girl, 13-year-old girl, that had been had applied, had been accepted, had a family. Things came up. That family could no longer take that girl. And Brooke and Jonathan Lawson have answered the call, and they're going to take the little girl. So that's a bunch of kids coming from Belarus that will be with us all summer long here at Re3. But that's just an example of just, you know, like saying, hey, there's things out there outside of our walls, outside of what we can do here at Re3. And we've always been about, we're not going to reinvent the wheel, right? If there's like all-star organizations out there, if there's world changers, if there's people that are doing stuff, there's no reason for us to try to recreate what they're doing. We want to go partner with them. We want to walk alongside of them and be part of what they're doing. And I had that opportunity last month. I got to meet a guy by the name of Mario. And Mario just had an incredible story. And we kind of connected real briefly at a pastor prayer breakfast. And we decided that we wanted to get together and find out a little bit more about one another. And so we met for coffee a few weeks later. And just hearing his story, I had that same feeling I had when I heard Kristen telling that story about Abra. Like there is a story to be told. And maybe, just maybe, there's someone here at Re3 that the story you're going to hear today from Mario might grab your heart, might do exactly what Daniel just said, might rise you up to be part of that army that says, I want to go serve. I don't know what it entails. I don't know what it's going to do, but I want to be part of this. And so before we go any farther, before I have a chance to really introduce Mario to you guys, take a look at this quick video, and it'll tell you a little bit more as we set the stage for his organization, MOVE.
In Iraq, ISIS marked our door with a red letter, which meant we had about 24 hours to leave. So we gathered our belongings and we fled to a neighboring country.
So we're in Bartala right now, which is a Christian town near Mosul. ISIS is really nearby. They've been trying to encroach on the territory here.
Everyone is fleeing. We're told upwards of 10,000 Christians are fleeing the area right now.
In India, my daughter was walking to school and she saw a man on a pedestal. And he was surrounded by a group of youths. The man told the youths that he wanted them to identify every Christian they met. He wanted them to burn their Bibles and even burn their cars.
These Christians insist their conversions are all voluntary, but they know now they won't be targeted.
In Sudan, I couldn't find a job for several years. Even a Muslim friend of mine said he could not hire me because offering a job to a Christian would get him in trouble. Actually, my name is Sean, and I'm an American citizen. There is no distinction between the free church and the persecuted church.
We are being persecuted,
so we stand together.
There is no them.
I hope I get the light. It's freed us. Is that right? They're close enough, or was it?
That's close enough.
Close enough. That's
those sell chips, at least.
That's my Greek Southern slang. So Mario, tell everybody where you're from, because by the accent, we'll be able to tell pretty quickly you're not from around here.
Well, why not? I can say good morning, y'all. I'm more Southerner than anybody here. I'm from Brazil, so it's only down south.
Well, awesome. So tell me just a snapshot of your life. Like, are you married, kids? Like, what's going on? Like, who is Mario that woke up this morning? Where are you from? And all that kind of stuff.
Well, I woke up this morning kind of sick, so forgive me for my voice. But it's an honor to be here. So I'm married to Giovanna for 16 years. We have three kids, 12, 8, and 5 years old, two girls and a boy. I've been serving in missions for about 20 years. I served in China for a few years, then came back to Brazil, and more international started about 10 years, a little less than 10 years ago, to serve persecuted Christians. That's what we do now full time. And we came to the U.S. to start an office of more We moved here less than 3 years ago, initially to the Philadelphia area. Then we moved to North Carolina in June last year. So I live close to Graham, Burlington, that area, so not too far away from here.
Okay. So your upbringing, I think what you were telling me was you went to seminary, right? I mean, you were geared and wired and wanted to be a pastor. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I was trained everything very early in my life. So I went to seminary at the age of 17, actually, right out of high school, and was ordained a pastor. Not that sounds too responsible, but I was 21. And yeah, so I've been doing that. I'm 42 now, so it's been almost 21 years of ordination. So,
okay.
Yeah.
But you didn't stay in Brazil and necessarily the church there very long. You ended up traveling and working with another organization.
Went to China, served for about 4 years, then came back to Brazil, pastored a couple churches in the meantime, and in 2010 more started.
So okay.
This organization.
So how do you go from, a 21-year-old seminary grad, pastoring some churches? You worked with, was it YWAM?
Yeah.
You worked with YWAM. You went to China, spent some time there, and then came back and did some more pastoring, but then started MOVE. Like, what was it that, I guess, how do you go from pastoring a church to all of a sudden wanting to start an international organization, a ministry that focuses on the persecuted church? I mean, there had to have been some kind of catalyst for that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I had one specific experience in China that completely, turned my life around, and it's pretty much the reason why I'm here today. So can be a little bit of a long story, but I'll make it short. In China initially, I served an organization that was actually out of YWAM, and we were like a company for cultural exchange programs in China. So in other words, we would place teachers in Chinese universities, English teachers or students of the Chinese languages, Chinese language foreigners in several states of China. So I did that for a few years. I would travel around with the team and talk to the universities. It was a good strategy because all these professors that we planted there were missionaries, most of which with YWAM. So it was a good thing. And then in the midst of that, one day I met a person that God used that encounter to change my life. So this man, I came across his store, actually. He was he made wire framed stuff, like the Chinese characters, those little dragon things for you to put up on the wall. Very talented man. And I saw the fish of Christianity as one of the wires he was selling out of his store. So, and I know that, I knew back then that didn't mean anything in China, that fish that we have in the back of our car sometimes, And I saw that, and he saw me looking at that on the window. I wasn't gonna buy it. I was traveling past his town, really. And he said, "Well, are you part of the fish?" He asked that to me in Mandarin, and in my broken Mandarin, I said, "Yeah, I am part of the fish." I think they think every foreigner is a Christian, especially in that part of China. So it ended up that guy invited me to go to church with him the next day. And we went to, it was my first contact with the underground church of China. So long story short, we traveled. It was him, his wife, his daughter, teenage daughter, she spoke English, and myself in the back seat. And we traveled like 40 minutes out of town, took the highway. He pulled his car to the shoulder. There was this bush, this tree thing. He hid his car behind this tree. And we walked another 40 minutes in the woods to go to church. I didn't see any cars, didn't see any houses, didn't see anybody. We just, just woods. My thoughts were like, if I was here alone with this man, I would be scared to death, but his family's here, so it must be fine. And then we got to this old abandoned building, like gray communist-looking building. It was probably, I wouldn't say it was like a brick factory, but totally abandoned in the middle of the woods. I didn't see anybody at first. When he opens the door, there are 250 Christians worshiping there. All of them traveled 40 minutes by car, 40 minutes walk, hid their cars behind bushes. They did the exact same process that man did just to get together as church. So that was a first hit already, right?
Now, and but the original city that you're coming from, was it like a major city? I mean, where was this?
It was a small city in China, like 2 million. You know?
Okay.
One of those that you barely have on the map.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was crazy, you know. But the part of the story that really changed my life was this. I joined their service. No instruments, no electricity whatsoever. So beautiful worship, a cappella worship, you know, and the church is passionate, on fire, and there's this leader man, we'll call him the pastor. He is, you know, very motivational, you know, and then he invites two families up front. That's the core of the story. Two families. I refer as family number one and family number two. Family number one, a man in his 50s, his wife, and his two kids, a college age son and a teenage daughter. Family number two, a younger couple holding a baby. Family number one, they had a very, their face was very sad. Like, they looked devastated. They didn't look good at all. And the man was actually holding a Bible. The second family, family number two, they were kind of cheerful. So I'm thinking, okay, pastor will probably pray for families. No, I wasn't understanding most of the service. So probably family number one lost a dear one. He's going to pray for them. Family number two, they'll probably dedicate the baby or something. That was my thought. Then I asked the girl, what's going on here? The translator, you know, she was sitting by me, and she said, oh, this is the Bible ceremony. The Bible ceremony, what's that about? Can you translate? And she started translating, and the man of family number one started sharing, and he said, well, was holding the Bible like this, his family looking sad right by him, and his first line was very confusing. He said, this week was the best week of the history of our family. And I thought, I don't want to be around this guy on his worst week. No, didn't look good at all. And then he kept going. He goes, because the word of God dwelled in our house. I was really silly. I was like, what does that mean? He said, well, this week I didn't go to work. My wife didn't go to work. My kids didn't go to school. My boy's the best reader. So we would like wake up like very early, dawn, you know, and we would start reading the Bible together. My son would read out loud for us. We wouldn't, even our meals would be reading the Bible. Like my wife, we would read in the kitchen. So she would prepare the meals, listening to the Bible. We would eat in front of the Bible. We never stopped until we had no more strength left late at night, you know. In this 1 week, we were able to read the Bible, the whole New Testament as a family, and the Old Testament from Genesis to Joshua. And the reason why we are sad, and this time he started weeping, he couldn't barely talk. He says, that I know that by the church size and by the church roster, we will only be able to host the Word of God in our house again 1 year from now. And at that moment, I realized that church at 250, they had one Bible to share, and he was passing that one Bible to the happy family. That would be the sad family next week, doing the same thing. They actually had two Bibles, one for the pastor to prepare sermons, and the other one for the congregation to share every week. And I was sitting there, you know, and I had one Bible that I used to travel with, and it was my Bible for devotional, for everything. And I had eight other Bibles sitting in my house in Hong Kong that I would barely touch just for sermon prep. And all these commanded different Bibles that people gave to me as gifts, and I felt like, I just felt filthy that day. I felt unworthy of sharing the same faith with them. And that was my second encounter with Jesus, if that exists, you know. That was my my calling to the persecuted church. I just felt this is wrong. This, someone needs to change this. I don't know what I can do, but I will work my life toward this issue. And that's how the Lord called me to work with the persecuted church.
So you came back to Brazil, were pastoring churches. What was that feeling like before you started MOVE? I mean, like, there had to have been almost like a reorganizing of thoughts, kind of like recalibrating the way you see the world, the way you see church, the way you see the ministry, a calling, like that whisper of God saying, I need you to do something. What was it like during that time period from coming home from China to when MOVE finally got started? What was that season in your heart and soul like?
Well, it was almost like an 8-year gap between coming back from China. I actually got married in between, and you know, and I pastored a couple different churches before we started the ministry with MOVE. But I must confess that I don't know if I ever made that adjustment you're talking about. You know, it's very hard for you to be able to even consider some of our church struggles the same way after you've been through things like that. You know, especially my last year in China, that was pretty much what I did full time, like to connect with the underground church. And so I had to struggle. I struggled a lot back in Brazil not to be judgmental, mm-hmm. not to be, and I'm opening my heart here because my what the Holy Spirit needed to keep revealing to my heart was, wait, nobody else saw what you saw. You know, nobody else went through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And people are not gonna go on board with that if you make them feel bad about it. So that was never the goal, you know. So I think God was like preparing me during these 8 years. And my family and I, my wife was also with YWAM for 5 years before I even met her. So we all shared this feeling that we would go back to this sometime. And I think those 8 years were the preparation as a family so that we could do that.
Okay. So MOVE. Like what, I guess what was that final thing that made you want to just step out in faith? Like what was the first couple of days, weeks, months, years of MOVE like? Like what was it that finally, because obviously you got to that point where you said, I can't do this anymore as far as pastoring a local church. Like I'm ready to do more. So what was it that kind of was that spark, and what were those early days like of MOVE, and you know, what do you?
Well, this is actually kind of funny because there was this moment in my ministry in 2010 where I was doing really good at church. Like I was the senior pastor of a church of 600, had a good pastoral team, you know, everything was going well in this nice city in Brazil, you know, big city. And I, if you ask me, I didn't have any reasons to get out of that, you know. Another funny thing, the way the Lord works is, MOVE didn't start off necessarily with the persecuted church at first. We started as a response to the earthquake in Haiti, which is a completely odd thing, you know, for my perspective. But I decided to go as a church pastor in a trip with other pastors to Haiti right after the earthquake. I got there January 27, 2010. Earthquake was January 12th, so 15 days after, and it was terrible, you know, but I didn't know anything about disaster relief whatsoever. But we went there just to bring some relief to churches and pastors and see what we could do. Brazil was doing awesome economically back then. When we started spreading the word, we're going to Haiti, we're going to Haiti, we're going to Haiti, in 9 days, the seven pastors, we raised $300,000 donated. We didn't even have a bank account. Like for that, we couldn't use a church bank account. You know, there was no organization. We just had a lot of money and the heart to do the ministry in Haiti, you know. And then as we discussed, okay, this should become a fund, or we should at least have a bank account, you know, to report to people and stuff. So, okay, let's come up with a name here. And the name MOR in Portuguese is MAIS, and in M-A-I-S. And that's in Portuguese an acronym. And we came up with Mission in Support of the Suffering Church. That's what we used. The idea was, let's help the church that is suffering in different contexts, including persecution, disaster, even war, you know. So it was a little broader concept, you know. In 2010, though, I went 11 times to Haiti. I spent 92 days altogether, and I was the senior pastor of a church. That's impossible, you know. So kind of naturally, things drew my family towards doing that full time, you know. So 2011, we made that decision. We told the church. We did a transition, so our assistant pastor became the senior pastor. He still is, and that's why we're here.
And MOR was created.
MOR was created like that.
So what was the transition like? Because now you're predominantly a ministry to support the persecuted church.
Exclusively.
So what was that final transition then from helping churches in need, pastors in need, whether it be natural disasters or whatever it may be, to saying, you know what? The persecuted church needs MOR.
Yeah. So, well, 2011 through 2013, the growth that MOR experienced was like, we can't explain. You know, it was just, we started 10 different bases besides Haiti. So 11 work bases around the world. So we went to Colombia. We started ministry in Uganda to help Christians from Burundi, Congo, and the surrounding countries. We started a base in Thailand to help Myanmar, Laos, and some other countries there. We started Italy to help refugees that came from Pakistan, persecuted Christians. So we were going all over the place and sending Brazilian missionaries to lead that process, but working with nationals. So the ministry just grew a lot. Our main base became the one that we have in Jordan right now. Right now we have a very good work in Jordan that helps persecuted Christians from Syria and Iraq especially, and other countries of the Middle East. So as we kind of did a map of what we were doing, we just looked at it and said, well, most of our work is with the persecuted church. And when we see ministries taking care of the persecuted church, there's a lot MOR necessity than, it's not that there's no necessity in disaster relief, but there's a lot MOR people that do a better job in that than when you compare to the persecuted church. So mm-hmm. How about we focus on that? But that decision was made about 3 years ago to go and make the cut that way, you know, so that we can focus MOR. So right now we're expanding to countries where we weren't working before, but they are all persecuted related, like Pakistan and even China. Funny thing that I served in China personally, but MOR never did. So now we're going back to China. So this is now possible.
Yeah. So you talked about Africa, China, Europe, South America. You're in all these various places. I can't imagine it's a one size fit all. Like or maybe I'm wrong. Like I can't imagine what the church needs in China may be the same as the church in Uganda or the church in Jordan. Or explain that dynamic. Or is it a one size fit all?
No, not at all. And I really like that question, by the way, because here in the West, when you present an organization, it's really much about what do you guys do. That's the number one question. So, what do you guys do for the persecuted church? And as an organization, though, we made a decision to struggle with that question a little bit because it's MOR about who we help than what we do for them. So we just say we walk alongside with the persecuted Christians, because when you see there are 215 million persecuted Christians out there today, that kind of persecution strikes them in different levels. I can give you several examples here. So in Sudan, where a Christian cannot work by law in the northern part of Sudan, a Muslim is not allowed to offer a job to a Christian. So what Moore did there was to offer microfinance so that Christians would start their own businesses. So that was the strategy that God gave to us to help to walk alongside with persecuted Christians. Are we a microfinance organization? No, I don't think so. We don't even know a lot about microfinance, but in three or four of the places where we work, that's what we do. In Iraq, we had no microfinance to give when the Islamic State is pretty much killing every Christian. They needed out. So we did help with escape and resettlement. Only in Brazil, we hosted about 240 persecuted Christians from Iraq or Syria who are victims of the Islamic State, and all Christians running away. Are we a refugee organization? No, we are not. But we did help persecuted Christians with resettlement. There are places that all they need from us is training, you know. So we really tailor our actions according to the need of the persecuted church. That's what we try to do.
Wow, that's awesome. I mean, that's phenomenal. What a simple but should be common concept. I mean, you know, but man, if every church and mission organization did that, man, can you imagine how much the world would be different? I love that. That's beautiful.
It's kind of hard to explain, especially when you don't really speak English. But it is. That's what we decided to work with. Yes.
Oh, I love it. So right now, let's say someone from our congregation or any congregation or a church in particular, a community came up and said, "We want to help you. What can we do to help you with more? What's some ways we can help? I mean, is it financial support, prayer support? Is it, do you need bodies on the ground? Like, come take a short-term mission trip and come help with this? I mean, what do you need?"
Okay. So also, of course, an obvious question and very important one. And we also struggle with that one all the time because we do not work in a sphere that we can bring a lot of people over, if that makes sense. Like, we are dealing with people that cannot really show their faces, and, you know, for security issues, it's very hard to sometimes bring teams and stuff. There is a couple locations where we do that because we do need the help. For instance, Jordan is one where we take teams. Okay, we even have a guest house for that, but it's not possible in every other location, you know, that where we operate. But what I like to say, wherever I go, is that we are really recruiting intercessors. You know, we do need funds, of course we do. We do need volunteer work in different spheres. We're starting an office here. So, you know, right now, I didn't even introduce my guys here, but Sam Apps is a friend of mine that's here with me today. And Rufus Terry works with Moore International with me, so he came in as my lumberjack bodyguard. No, he is he's an intern with Church Partnerships Development, helping me to do this, exactly this. And so our team is small. You know, it's like Rufus and I and a couple other people thinking all the strategies on how we're going to mobilize and how we're going to make the cause of the persecuted church more known within the American church. So it is a challenge. So of course we need hands-on for that kind of stuff. We need volunteers. But prayer, so if I can tell a short story about prayer,
yeah.
Very, very quick.
We'll stay here at 5 o'clock. We don't care.
Okay, me neither. So it's good. A few months ago, an organization that partners with us, the Voice of the Martyrs, that a lot of people might know, they called us and asked if we could help them by hosting a Pakistani that was running away from a terrorist group in Pakistan. He was caught by this group. He was held hostage for a while. They beat him up. They did all kinds of cruel stuff to him. But then this guy was able to flee from that, you know, situation. But they needed him out of the country. So, and Brazil can be a good spot for that because paperwork is less, you know, bureaucratic, if you understand. So it was just quicker. So they called us, can you guys do anything about, yeah, we have our base down in Brazil, just send him to us. And this guy arrives, I'll call him Joseph here, okay? So Joseph gets there. So Moore has a legal team. My wife is an attorney. She used to work with a legal team before he came here. So they did his paperwork for asylum in Brazil. And then the idea is, after his paperwork is done, we ask for his family reunion. So they would bring his wife and two kids, okay? That was the original idea. But then when we're almost ready to start his paperwork, Joseph receives a phone call from his brother in Pakistan saying, remember the terrorist group that had you hostage? Yes. Okay, they have now your 10-year-old son, and they will not talk to anybody else but you. They will not negotiate. You have to come back. So that guy goes back to Pakistan to turn himself in for the life of the kid. At that moment, we did not have any other thing to do but pray, if that makes any sense. Like, we interact with the UN at some level. We have connections. But you're talking about an Islamic nation that allows groups to do that kind of stuff on purpose, okay? And you cannot have political connections that will solve that, you know? There's no money that would, you know, buy his son out of that situation. So we needed prayer. We could not communicate the guy's name, the guy's nationality. We couldn't mention the voice of the martyrs. We only had, you know, to believe that people would trust us and pray. There is this persecuted Christian turning himself in for his son's life, you know. And we started a prayer campaign in Brazil. In Brazil, the organization is bigger, like, let's say, 150,000 followers on Facebook, you know, so you can do some mobilization a little more easily. Well, we started that prayer campaign, and we had this amazing problem. Our server crashed. Like, we had 800,000 intercessors sign in, saying, we want to pray for this guy, without knowing anything. We just knew that he's turning himself for his kid's life. You know, 800,000 people did that. Amazing. The guy gets back to Pakistan, turns himself for the kid. They release the kid the next day. Praise God. That prayer was answered. But now we have another problem. And we've been working against groups like that. Honestly, my faith was too little to believe he would get out of there, you know. But we started another prayer campaign, and this time we had a million people praying for that guy, 1 million. 3 days later, he texts my phone saying, I am home. Praise God. You know, no money, no political connection. That was just the prayer of the church. So here, we do not have the same kind of connections yet, because we're starting an office. We barely have an office. I'm working kind of out of Andy Bowersock's office. You know? So we don't know many people. So the way we do it is going to churches like this, asking people to sign up, like to get a newsletter, to give us their information so that they keep getting newsletters online or like this 4 times a year, and that we can communicate how you guys can pray for the persecuted church. The links that we send and everything also direct to you if you want to make donations. Yes, if you want to know how to engage, if we need a specific thing, if we have a specific volunteer position or something, yes, it will all be there. But it's mostly for prayer. So that's the main way that people can help us.
Fantastic.
Sorry, I speak too much.
No, you're great.
I speak more in Portuguese. So
no, you're... Let me get personal. What do you need? I mean, this has to be a lot on your shoulders, hearing the weight of this organization, caring not just the persecuted church, but the people that you know that are being persecuted, like this gentleman, his son, you know, that you know personally. Like, how can we pray for you? What can we do to support you right now?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I also need prayers in the first place, and this is very honest. In terms, even in emotional terms, as you said, I could tell stories here. I was just sharing with Sam in the car, like a couple of things at the persecuted church. It's is all I have to talk about, you know. And we are in touch with these people pretty much all day. And it really can mess you up, you know. In these years of more, I moved here 3 years ago, but before that, I was traveling around these fields, you know. It's 59 nations in 6 years, you know. And seeing the reality of that from such a close range, that you do get a little messed up, you know. So pray for that. Pray for the family. Pray for. Right now we are going to Brazil for the summer, and it's the first time we go back home after 3 years in the U.S. And we're waiting for our green card to come through. So pray for that. We're raising funds for our tickets at 5 in the family, which is also a big deal. So pray for that. But I would say that the emotional and spiritual baggage is the most important thing for the kind of ministry that we do.
Right. Yeah. How many do you have working, I guess, with more? You named a handful of countries that you're in. Do you have the exact total? Like what? How many countries are you in as far as bases, and how many people do you think you actually have on the ground serving?
We have about 90 people on the ground right now, and I would say maybe 40 Brazilians and 50 plus nationals. You know, that would be our team. We have a pretty big team in the Brazil office, you know, and in all these bases I mentioned, you always have 2, 3, 4 people from Brazil as well, mm-hmm. you know, so, but our emphasis is on nationals. We see ourselves, as I said, the original name of the organization is Mission and Support of the Suffering Church. So we're not doing the work on behalf of them. We are supporting their work. Mm-hmm. You know, so our director in all these countries is a national. So next week I'm going to have in town the director of our base in Jordan. So he's going to come and speak to some pastors and stuff. So he's a Jordanian. You know, we have Brazilians helping him, but he's the leader. So, yeah, about maybe close to 100 people right now.
Okay. And what you mentioned your wife and kids. How do they feel about this? I mean, this has to be scary. You know, I would think that you're going off 59 different countries in 6 years. Some of the places may be more dangerous than others. You know, like how's your wife or how's your kids? How do they feel about being part of more and them being part of more? You know, this being their life now.
Yeah, well, every time I left my house, my wife would ask if health insurance was covered.
Life insurance. Yeah.
I'm kidding. Well, as I said, someone like me, I had to marry a crazy person too, right? she was also a missionary, and she has the same kind of heart, very supportive, no complaints. For the kids, of course, I even went through some struggle with that for a little while because there were years that I was on the road for 240 days a year, and that's not good. Wouldn't do that again, you know. So, but that could be doing another kind of work as well. So it's not really the type of ministry, but the absence. Mm-hmm. So that was tougher on the kids, you know, back then. Right now that I am home and I work with this type of work, but from home, they are way more engaged. I'm talking more about the kids. Also, they're growing up, so they understand better what I do, and it's encouraging, you know. So my daughter, she's 12, and she keeps talking about moving to China, you know, and that kind of stuff is pretty encouraging to see how the kids look at ministry positively when, you know, when God is blessing it. So it's a good thing.
I think we have maybe another minute or two. Just anybody have a question? I mean, we'll just do a quick Q&A. Is something that Mario said kind of speak to your heart, and you want to just ask him a question about any of this, or everything good? Q&A? Yeah.